Today, a rumble in the jungle. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, working with this post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In the last few days, I've had a number of people ask about some of my underlying opinions and thoughts relating to the Australian economy. And so today, what I'm going to do is just make a few general comments about what I see. So we'll consider things like government policy, household debt, the mining boom, and other factors too. And there are some rather concerning questions that we need to discuss. Given that central banks are continuing to quantitatively ease, the liquidity question, and particularly reverse repos, is also worth thinking about insofar that reverse repos, to my mind, are a signal of the question about strategy. I think the times are extremely uncertain at the moment, and there are lots of conflicting signs and a lot of ambiguity. And I think that what I find interesting is a lot of people assume that central banks know what they're doing. And I think once you start realizing that maybe they don't, then it does change the perspective quite significantly. There's a difference between reverse repos and repos, right? So basically, the repos is the central bank putting more liquidity into the banking system. The reverse repos is the banking system putting money back in the central bank, right? And it's the reverse repos that's gone very high. So that basically suggests there's so much liquidity in the system that effectively there's nowhere for it to go. And so that's another indicator, I think, of the fact that we're getting close to the end of the sort of cycle. So I don't know when that's going to end, but yeah. So watch the reverse repos. The reverse repos is probably the best example of the central bank policy failing. There's liquidity sloshing around, it's got no home, so they just park it back at the central bank. So it's a round trip, right? The central bank continues to do quantitative easing, goes into the banking system and the finance system, and then the finance system then puts it back at the central bank. So it's just a round trip. So, assets and liabilities both going higher, not necessarily creating any real value, and that's why a lot of people are now saying, well, maybe this is less inflationary than we thought. So it's just a symbol of the, frankly, the stupidity. It hasn't gone into the real economy. It hasn't actually, created any real value. It's just gone around the system. It's still in the banking system rather than the real economy. So if you look at there's a thing called the breadth of the economy. So in other words, if you look internationally and compare different economies, how broad based are economies around the world, right? Ours is one of the narrowest based anywhere, right? So we have mining, which ultimately is iron ore, and so what's happening with the iron ore price is critical. And then we have consumers and consumer spending, and a lot of that is directly related to the wealth effect from the property boom. And if you look at the relativities, right, there's about $8 to $9 trillion sitting in property in Australia. There's about $3 trillion sitting in superannuation and bugger all elsewhere, basically. So most households have most of their wealth in property, right? Most of the policies in Australia in the consumer perspective has been to try and drive property prices higher, get people effectively to pay bigger mortgages. Rates have come down. That means that people can borrow more. So that sort of has been in train for 30-odd years or so. And that's the problem, really, that, if those levers can't continue to be pulled. So, for example, you can't cut rates much lower than where they are. So that's a problem. And if the iron ore price comes down from where it was at over 200, it's now, 150, 160, and is likely to come further down. Now, the question is, what is the base of growth in the economy in Australia over the next decade, right? And at the moment, there's no answer to that, right? So we are quite fragile, I think. Now, they will go on pumping house prices. They'll throw more money at first-time buyers. They threw $3 billion over the last 12 months into the property sector. $3 billion, big number, right? But it's not solving the structural issue that clearly is there. And the other point is a lot of property investors who used to buy aren't buying anymore because they can't see how they can get a return. So the price-to-income ratio is a lot higher here than almost anywhere else around the world. And That means that people are more and more committed to those bigger mortgages. Now, of course, the argument is, well, affordability is good because rates have come down really low. And if you look at it in terms of how much on average people are paying as a proportion of their income, it hasn't moved that much. But just think about it. What has happened is the interest rates come down, the value of the mortgage has gone up, the net effect is roughly, you know, roughly similar. Of course, if rates start to go up at any time, that's a big issue. But the other is it's not equally spread. So if you look at new first-time buyers coming into the market, their loans 15% bigger, right? It's still big. It's huge. When incomes have not risen at all. So what you've got is a concentration of debt amongst younger borrowers who are being dragged into the market because of government policies, right? At a time when, of course, they are seeing prices moving higher. I mean, they're moving higher than I expected, because I didn't think the government was going to be so stupid, and I didn't think the Reserve Bank was going to be so stupid. But hey, I underestimated their stupidity once again. And if you look at it on this national basis, if you look at some of the, you know, the BIS numbers, right? So we are way up there, right, on debt to GDP, debt to income ratio, all of the ratios. So we are an outlier. And it's not because we're good economic managers. It's just that people are basically highly leveraged into property. And that's why, you know, 41% of people are now in difficulty from a cash flow perspective on those mortgages, even now, even with rates really low. So it is a recipe for risk. And again, government don't want to actually admit it. So they say, no, it's all supply side problems. It's all, you know, there's not enough property being built, except there's 1.2 million spare properties in Australia at the moment. So it's not really an undersupply. There's an oversupply, and there's more being built, you know, high rise being built, right? And of course, we've got net zero migration at the moment. So the mythology that they're putting out is it's nothing to do with us at the federal level. It's all to do with down in the state level. It's the fact that they haven't got planning rules sorted out, etc. Now, that's complete misdirection, right? The policy settings at the federal level and at the Reserve Bank are to blame for what's happened here. And yet the Reserve Bank and APRA and the government all say house prices, nothing to do with us. So the 1.2 million is currently what's available. There's more being built. There's another 200,000 to 300,000 properties on the stocks. So it's worth just sort of reflecting on the construction sector, right? So a lot of the building that's done in Australia at the moment is using imported goods and materials. And a lot of those goods and materials come from places like China, where they can make them cheap. In some cases, the quality might not be up to it, but frankly, the quality checks are so low here in Australia that nobody really notices. Now, what's happening at the moment is the supply chains are getting quite stretched, and so some of those some of the materials are actually just not landing. So what is that is having is a significant impact on the construction prices here locally. So if you look at the cost of timber, for example, and some of the other raw materials, it's gone very high, and the delivery time frames have really shot out. Now that means that if you're building something here, it's going to take longer to build because you're going to have to wait longer for the supply chains to work, assuming you can still get the materials. And the other factor is that we've got a over surge of new building thanks to the home builder. So we've got a lot of construction that's been sort of contracted but hasn't yet started, or has started and then stopped. So if you look around the place, there are a lot of half-finished projects around the place at the moment. All of that is having a very significant impact on the price of those builds. So we're seeing the cost of materials rising. I showed an example from the US the other day in one of my shows, which showed that the costs of raw materials in the US has significantly spiked. So it isn't just an Australian thing, it's a global thing. And that means that the cost of building new is going up. Well, what's the first thing you do? What you do is you actually try to cut corners. So that means that there's going to be more downward pressure on the quality of construction, right, which is already pretty bad here. And there are lots of defects that we see in new builds. So I think that's the sort of the way it's going to play out. And whether, in fact, the supply chains will self-correct is the big question, right? So there are a number of people who say, well, these are just short-term hiatuses because of COVID, et cetera, and once things settle down, the supply chains will come back. Or is this a more structural change? So in other words, is China, for example, now focusing its investment plans on other things? And if they are, Do those supply chains ever come back to where they were previously, or are we always going to see now higher costs, higher transportation costs, you know, the quality still not being very, very good? All of those things are potentially in play, and that just now puts more pressure on the construction sector here, because we make very few of the raw parts of that are used in developments here in Australia. Most of it's imported. So the migration has been quite strong. If you look over the last few years, we've had more population growth from migration than from natural growth. People still fall off the perch at the end of, you know, at the end of their lives, and then that the birth rate is actually lower than it was. In the current environment, I think the population growth that was projected to be very strong is now quite a lot weaker. Now, they'll probably reopen the borders and they'll probably try and pull more people in because, frankly, the only other lever they've got is migration, right? The only other lever they've got is to increase the number of people in the country, and that will actually increase GDP because more people will spend more, right? So, and I've argued over the last decade, our first wave of quantitative easing was actually quantitative easing via population growth. That's what they've been doing. It's a deliberate policy setting. And it's all to do with those policy settings, the quantitative easing, the low interest rates, the reduction in the lending standards, all of those things. You know, there will be a point when it can't go on. Now, I don't know where that point is because, you know, as I said earlier on, the government is proving itself to be much more willing to just keep doing the same again and again and again and again and just... So my expectation is they'll do another version of Home Builder. You know, they'll find some way. The other point I'd make is that the construction sector employs a lot of people, more than 1 million people, and the construction sector has a very strong voice. And so what you often see is that the government is actually also cajoled by the construction sector and by the finance and banking sector, because, of course, that's a huge part of the economy too. So the power blocks of the construction sector, the finance sector, are very strong lobbyists. And so when you actually realise that the interests of the government are more aligned with those groups, because they are very powerful, and then the mining group, of course, the third power block, so those elements together are all on the same side of the equation. And the other point I'd make there is that's true on both sides of politics. So, you know, it's not like this is a, you know, one side of politics. Both sides of politics play the same game on this. So it is a political alignment, aligned to power, aligned to specific industry groups. But what it is doing, it is forcing this economy to become more and more distorted. So it started when the financial sector was deregulated in the 80s and 90s. Then we had essentially interest rates coming down, and rates were coming down. And then we had the global financial crisis, which was a catalyst for some of this. We also had, of course, the mining boom, and the mining boom carried us through the early 2000s, and then that sort of fell away. So really, from about 2005 onwards, the strategy has been very strongly to use the household sector and to use that as the growth engine, right? And as other industries, you know, manufacturing disappeared, and, you know, the manufacturing base here is narrower than it's been probably forever. As other factors disappeared out of the equation, rather than the government of the time trying to lead the way forward in terms of innovation and new businesses and, you know, new development opportunities, they basically put all their eggs in the China basket from a exports perspective, and they use the housing sector and household budgets and all of the stuff we've been talking about in terms of the wealth effect to try and actually keep the economy going. And the problem partly is, if you measure outcomes in terms of the GDP, it doesn't matter where the activity is, right? Because it's all activity. And so from a purely GDP perspective, you could say, well, that's all right. Although if you look at GDP per capita, it's not as good. But my view is that the metrics that they're using is actually not very helpful in terms of understanding. It's not strategic in nature. It's not thinking about where are we going to take our economy over the next 10 years? What are the critical growth areas that we should be investing in? How do we actually get a catalyst? How do we broaden the base of the economy? How do we bring small businesses through? How do we actually find new things to do? All they're doing is using the old playbook from the 90s and the 2000s, running it again and again and again and hoping for a different outcome. They ain't going to get that. So, unfortunately, the growth path as currently portrayed, and that was even happening before COVID, but COVID has really thrown a magnifying glass on this, right, means that we are not necessarily well placed to be able to navigate the next decade or two unless we pull the same levers again, which is migration, keep house prices going up, and find some other means to sell our resources overseas, and, you know, never mind the carbon footprint of that. So unfortunately, it is a strategic problem, but it's a 30-year problem at least. So they need international travel to come back, and they need it to come back soon. And partly they need it because they need migration to come back. They need people coming into the country. It's the cannon fodder for the economy, right? So we will see, we will absolutely see a significant spike in migration, which will be government engineered. Absolutely. Well, it depends on what they do with COVID and when they open. You know, they're talking now at sort of 70 or 80% vaccine coverage. You know, we'll open the borders and things. So, yes, it's probably early next year. Originally, of course, they were expecting it at the start of this year. If you go back 12 months, if you look at the Treasury modelling, they sort of assumed that the COVID thing would be over and everything would pick up. So, you know, there might be another variant. There might, like the South African variant, the latest one is looking pretty virulent. But yeah, my assumption has been at the moment that the migration lever would be played probably into next year. Although it does take a bit of time for the lever to be pulled and, you know, think people to come in. So you'd expect migration to start picking up next year. But the question is, what else? What other policies have they got? If they don't use the migration and cheap money and, you know, loose lending standards, and of course, you notice that Jos Frydenberg has basically said to ASIC, your responsibility now is to help growth. It's not to actually regulate the financial system. How does that work? You know, I thought the regulator was there to actually keep us safe. And, you know, APRA not interested in house prices, and APRA, frankly, just looking after the interests of the banks. So we've got, you know, ASIC and APRA basically, you know, well, not doing their job probably. So the question is, if they don't open the taps and bring migration in, what other levers are there? And the answer is, it's hard to see other levers. Manufacturing is pretty much stagnant at the moment. There isn't a huge amount of investment in terms of new innovation and new businesses and those sorts of things. So, of course, if iron ore continues its downward path, then there are people saying, well, it could get back to $50, you know, because that's really the cost of production. It means that effectively the critical value-adding component in the economy over the last couple of years, and it's been surprising on the upside, could start surprise on the downside. And it's interesting, Treasury modelling always assumed that iron ore would come back to $75 or whatever it is, right? So they've always assumed that it would come back. It's just a question of it hasn't until recently. But now if China's policies suggest that maybe iron ore is actually due for a correction, and we're seeing, you know, significant downward pressure. So, the question is, what else is in the kit bag, right? Well, actually, it's the things we've really been looking at. You know, it is migration. It is trying to get more people to borrow more, to buy more houses, and to try and keep momentum going on there, because the wealth effect is quite strong, which people feel that their house prices are going up. They've got more access to more equity. They can then recycle that. So you sort of cycle that through the economy. But it's horribly narrow, and it's quite risky, and it is not strategic. And I just, you know, I get a bit cross with federal governments, because they're not interested now in strategy in terms of developing a plan for the future. This is just getting to the next election, right? It is very narrow. It's very, very limited. And it's more about winning the next election, and it's more about spin, and it's more about trying to convince people that they're doing a really good job when they're not, than actually tackling the fundamental questions that I think are there and the fundamental economic debates we should be having. And there is an opportunity, right? So, you know, the green revolution, the innovation that can come off that, the fact that we've got the ability to pull raw materials out of the ground to make batteries, and yet we just ship them overseas and get somebody else to make them, and then we bring them back into the massive. I mean, there are things that could have been done if there had been vision, but there was no vision. And the question is, where is the vision now? What is the vision for Australia now? You know, where's it going to be in 10 years time? Are we just going to, you know, continue to run house prices ever higher, get people to be ever more in debt, extend the average life of a mortgage? You know, the average life used to be 25 years, now it's 35 years. Well, it should be 45, 50 years. Well, in Japan, there are intergenerational mortgages. I mean, there are things that can be done but they're not things that actually take us necessarily to that strategic high ground that we need to be able to lay an economic foundation for the next generation and beyond. And that is why I get really frustrated with the current political debate in Australia, and why I get so frustrated when a lot of the economists out there just sort of cycle the current arguments without thinking strategically about the broad picture. So I think the rare earths is a really interesting opportunity. And I do think that if we could convince those that it's not just sufficient to pull it out of the ground and flog it overseas, but we actually need to add the value added elements post the production, right? That's the secret. We're in a hugely resource rich country in Australia. And yet we're not capitalising on that. We're not doing the value add. Right? We're a one-trick pony. We just dig it up the ground and flog it cheap. Or flog it expensive if we can get people. So I think there's an opportunity to think through more creatively. And I do think the rare earths is an interesting area. I'm not convinced that gold is as exciting. Because I actually, if you look at the long-term trends on the gold price, it hasn't really gone very far. There are people out there, and I interviewed Peter Schiff last year, and he was very keen on strong gold prices ahead. I tend not to believe that that's going to be the way it's going to be, but, you know, I could be wrong. So, but I think rare earths are quite interesting. The other is, you know, in some of the some of the bios, you know, there's some interesting stuff there. I interviewed Tony LeCantro quite recently, and he was talking about some of the, you know, the new drug therapies that are being developed. And some of those could be quite interesting too. Again, lack of innovation, but some going on there. And I think the third thing, coming back to this, you know, the Green Revolution, if you actually think that there is going to be, now, undoubtedly, there is going to be a need to be able to actually position ourselves more powerfully in the evolving world of green and renewable energies and those sorts of things. Eventually, things like electric vehicles, eventually things like the infrastructure to support charging across the country. I mean, those are the sorts of things that I would be thinking about, right, rather than just saying, oh, well, you know, we'll just run the old diesels a bit longer, right, you know, or we'll run coal a bit longer. So, again, it's about the vision thing. So there are definitely some potential growth engines, but there's no real focus in my view. And, in fact, of course, a lot of the funding that the government has thrown at sort of green isn't really green, you know, like, well, we'll build another gas power station, right, as though that's somehow, you know, taking us in the right direction. It probably isn't. It's just a sort of a bit of a stopgap, and it's a sort of a not quite as bad as coal, but it doesn't really help in terms of emissions. But again, it's about having the vision to be able to actually think differently. I think the other point I'd make is, you know, from an investment perspective, at the moment, the sector of the economy that's still performing very well is actually the finance sector, right? And that's because everybody is playing the game that the finance sector likes, which is more people borrowing more. You know, the margins on those loans might be a bit lower than they were, but the volume's still going up. So there is still some upside in the finance sector, and I think probably in the wealth management sector too. So, you know, I look at those as well. I do think that the resource sector, though, more generally, is probably going to be struggling because of the falling demand from China. And I'm not sure that we can decouple ourselves from some of the Chinese stories without significant downside risk. But I could be wrong on that. But it depends whether you can find other countries to buy the stuff that we were selling to China. So there you have it. A few thoughts. I hope you found those useful. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.